All right, everybody, welcome back to Sunday morning here at the 60th annual Daryl Starbird's Custom Auto and Truck Show. And I found one of my buddies down below painting and talking and BS.
Down below with the dregs of society.
Yeah, the lower end of life. I saw him down below. Wait, because I'm on the upper balcony. I don't want to brag, but I was. And I saw him down there, and I'm like, dude, we got to go talk to him.
You know, so, what? You're up here with all the big hitters, like at Cobalt Hall. All the big hitters are upstairs, and all the... You know, rat rotters are downstairs, so they keep it the same at all the car shows.
Is it all the same show?
I mean, rat rotters go downstairs.
Rat rotters go downstairs. So, for most of you who don't know, obviously, Big Daddy is his father. So I got Little Daddy Roth right here this morning with me, hanging out and chewing the fat a little bit.
Yeah, you know, when Dad was alive, he told me sign your name Big Daddy Junior. You know, but when Dad died in 2001, I go, you know what? I'm just going to be Little Daddy Roth now because. Actually, that's what was my name when I was 17 years old in the Army when you had mail call.
Really?
Big Daddy had sent me letters. You know, had the Big Daddy logo on it.
He did that right away. Yeah, even in the Army, that's how he sent it to you.
Yeah, and the clerk.
That's so wild.
Yeah, so when the clerk got up there to call out mail call, they always called Little Daddy.
Really?
I just became Little Daddy when Dad died because I didn't want to sign my name like Big Junior. It sounded like Jumbo Shrimp.
I was going to say, you're kind of jumping up.
Big Junior? Who's that?
Who's Big Junior? Right. Somebody's going to start looking at down below. We're like, well, those guys pretty well endowed. You know what's going on, Big Junior?
Right.
So, Big Daddy, obviously, when it first started, when did the name Big Daddy first come out? How did this all epic Rat Fink whole world that everybody knows, it's all over the world, everywhere?
Oh, well, you know what? How that happened is a kid named Jimmy Keeler was 16 years old. He worked for Revell Incorporated. And my dad had just got rid of the Model A, you know, the little Jewel, and we built this deal. Well, I was in kindergarten. I didn't really work on any cars till the Beatnik Bandit came along, the next car. But he built the Outlaw.
We're talking early 50s now.
Yeah, we're talking, because I was born in 55, the year of the greatest Chevy ever. And yeah. The Outlaw came out, I think, we were building it in 58. I remember it being built. My older brother, you know, used to live inside of it. You know, when Dad was watching them.
When Dad was watching all stuff. Yeah. That is so killer, man.
So we only had a one little garage on Slauson Avenue. So Dad built it on the apron of the lot. But, you know, when that car came out.
This is California, right?
Yeah. When that car came out, it did change so many things. And Lynn, like I said, Jimmy Keeler got it. And they brought it over and to Revell.
Girls,
and,
thank you.
You know, made a model of it. And that was like, you know, the beginning of my mom and Dad signed a contract with Revell to supply a car a year.
Okay.
And so that kept all us kids busy, you know, like 70 hours a week building cars, because my mom and Dad didn't hire no one to build cars.
It was always a family ran business, right?
Yeah. And so, but there was people that worked there, like, you know, Dave Mann or Von Dutch or those guys, but they, Ed Newton, Robert Williams worked in the shop every day when I was a kid.
And I think a lot of people forget about this. And I mean, now, I mean, kids even, I mean, remember 2024. Yeah. It's so crazy. And Rat Fink and the toys, and they're still all over the place, and people are just going nuts for it. So I don't think a lot of people realize that Von Dutch, all these guys, started because of your father's shop.
Yeah, you know, he gave a lot of people that were, you know, like supposedly, you know, the downtrodden or the dregs or the worst, you know, of everything. And
yeah,
always gave him jobs and stuff. Like, you know, Robert Williams was working for a packaging company that made boxes for different size black glasses and cups. And Dad saw his drawings. He goes, you know, I'll hire you. Come in and be my art director. Because my dad and Ed Newton really never got along very good, you know. And so Ed Newton was out of there after about a year.
Okay.
And then Robert Williams came in. And but what happened was, after the first Outlaw was built, we had to build cars like once a year, like Beatnik Bandit, Rotar, Orbitron. They didn't make models of those cars, but the ones they did make model of the Beatnik Bandit. And then we got a car in there called a Tweety Pie, a Ford.
Yeah.
You know, Tweety Pie.
Yeah,
but, and so that was the first car my mom and Dad bought, customized, made a model of, and sold it right away because they didn't want to, you know, a Ford T-Bucket to be part of it.
So your father's idea, so Big Daddy's idea was, now a lot of people don't realize, we're talking about model kits, as we have a couple examples here shown on the desk here. So the model kits were all, that was the biggest thing for kids in the 50s and 60s.
Yeah.
So your dad,
it was before rock and roll. Like, we had albums out on Capitol Records called Rods and Rat Finks, Hot Rod Hootenanny, Surf Inc.
Man.
And Capitol Records. And so that was in 63. And when the Beatles got here in 64, you know, Dad always thought the Beatles knocked mom and dad out of the box. But Surf was big. And that was like, models were the first albums you could buy, you know, like, and have something cool at your house before, you know, when, I don't know, 63, 64, 65, Mysterion. I mean, my mom and dad sold, like, I think it was like 2 million copies of Tweety Pie the first year.
Come on.
No, yeah, 2 million.
You're talking in what, 66?
Yeah. Yeah, 2 million albums. Million two million albums, 2 million models. Yeah.
2 million models in 1966.
Yeah, dude.
For a dude that was just doing stuff out of his garage, I mean.
Right. And see, so it wasn't, damn, it wasn't man, for epic. This kid, Jimmy Keeler, bringing that into Revell. And then, you know, as time went on and we finally built the Surfite, you know, because we were building the cars that weren't symmetric. They were asymmetric. Yeah. It was a lot easier because after the Road Agent, you know, it was so symmetric. And look, we built the Orbitron, Surfite, Mysterion cars that were easier to build.
You know? Yeah. But these were all the ideas out of your dad's brain. I mean, just all or the artists that you guys had hired. Now everybody's coming up with ideas.
Well, I mean, there was always ideas, and like I can't even tell you because, like, growing up, there was thousands of ideas. Even as we were building the buck for the fiberglass, you know, to put over it. But in 64, 65, somewhere in there, the Surfite model was out on the shelves at the hobby shops. Mm-hmm. But Life magazine had, you know, wrote an article about the Hells Angels and put that dad was the, you know, supply sergeant to the Hells Angels, and Revell dropped him immediately.
I remember this. I'm glad you brought that up, man. That was so cool.
If you, like, you know, have a Surfite model original issue, they actually pulled those back off the shelf, though, so that's why those are worth the most amount of money now. You know, it's off the hook. Then they reprinted them real soon after that, too.
Really?
Yeah.
So after the Hells Angels episode incident there,
yeah.
So was there a lot of controversy? Dad lawyer up, or what's going on? Did he go after everybody, or what?
No, him and my mom got divorced. No, actually, there was just like a fight over, you know, it ended up being a fight with my dad and this guy called Carl Morrow. You know, took care of some business over at the shop one night, and that was over then.
Took care of some business at the shop, and then we're good.
Well,
to go,
you know,
man.
By then my dad was a twice black belt.
Yeah,
in Lima Llama and Taekwondo.
Yeah, I was gonna say your dad. I mean, it goes through, I mean, and, you know, obviously, you know, back in the day with my old man was a boxer and all sort of stuff like that, too. I mean, they were bikers, they're badass dudes back then. So your dad, I mean, above and beyond the cars, the marketing, all that stuff, I mean, he was in martial arts, he was everything. I mean, Big Daddy earned his name, Big Daddy.
Yeah, he did. He, you know, and, you know, the weird thing is, you know, by 67, 68, 69, when we had Chopper's Magazine, that was sucking so much money away from the T-shirt business.
Yeah.
And, you know, that it just went downhill. So when my mom and dad got divorced, you know, Big Daddy, he got all the cars. And that's when we put him in Movie World Cars of Stars.
Yeah.
And my mom got the business and Rat Fink, see?
Oh, so that's how that split up.
Oh, yeah. So my mom owned Rat Fink until the year 2000. But see,
and what year did they get divorced? In the late 60s?
In 70. So for 30 years, my mom owned Rat Fink, but dad was out there selling it, right?
Get out of here. Yeah, really. Well, he still knew he wanted to protect his brand.
Well, he was selling it to Moon Eyes, trying to get $1 million for Rat Pink. But what happened is, once he realized you can't sell stolen property, and, you know, Revell was still paying my mom in the year 2000. Well,
really?
He got married into the year 2000. So my dad took all this money he had from, you know, Moon Eyes and took my mom to get. My dad only really owned Rat Pink back in the 2000. And then he got married in 2000.
Yeah.
So when he died in 2001, he left Rat Pink to his last wife. I think it was about the sixth wife.
Really?
Yeah. And you know, yeah. So like,
Big Daddy got.
Yeah.
Big
so
Daddy
that's why you'll see a lot more like Rat Pink stuff in Moon Eyes catalog. You'll see taillight lenses, little pop up locks, ash.
Oh man, it's insane.
Yeah, because Moon Eyes sells a lot more Rat Pink stuff because they're trying to, you know, recoup that $1 million from dad.
Yeah.
After he. You know, when he finally did own Revell, when he finally did own, you know, Rat Pink, he, you know, left it to the people in Utah up there where he lived in, you know, Manti.
Really?
Big polygamous city up there. In
Utah. Wow, man. That's a hell of a story, man.
Yeah. But so my dad had three wives before he was Mormon. And then when he was Mormon, he had three more wives. Yeah. So he, you know, he was Big Daddy.
I mean, I guess the name goes all. No matter where you are, you got a Big Daddy up. No matter what you're in or what you jump yourself
in. Right,
yeah,
he gets it.
He's like, dude, I'm Big Daddy. Give me three more of those. Give me four more of those, man.
Right.
You know.
But you know, when I was a kid making shirts like for Mickey Thompson on Friday night, and then, you know, go and trade him, Mickey Thompson, the T-shirts for fuel for the dragster on Saturday morning at Lions, or, you know, Don Garlitz, all these guys, they were all my dad's friends, you know.
Yeah.
And Still to this day, dude, you know, I was down at Don's. I think, you know, I was only 8 years old selling decals at Lions Drag Strip, and Don was a big hitter already. You know, he was born.
He was a heavy hitter at that time, yeah, already, man.
He's the same age as my dad and my mom. He was born in 1932.
So, and dad was how old when he passed?
69, the age I am now.
Get the hell, he was only 69. This might be the last podcast we have a little dad here today, but so congratulations.
Yeah, so when I see those guys like Don, who's still alive, or Gene, you know, at Winfield, it's like, and, you know, those are my dad's friends that, you know, I always looked up to.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Now it's like, you know, they're the old guys, except for not being able to hear, you know, Gene and Don are doing real good.
Oh, my God. I mean, Gene's still painting cars.
Yeah, that's what I mean. I don't know how he's doing it.
Me neither, man. I saw a video the other day when he's old. Ian, I was talking to him, and I was like, he was like, yeah, you just painted another one. I'm like, I said, he's still doing it? He's like, he goes, dude, he goes to work every day.
Yeah, he does.
Shop every day.
Yeah.
So reflecting back of, like, we talk about what's going on in today's demographic, kids and all this other stuff.
Yeah.
You're 8 years old. You're on a drag strip, and you're exchanging T-shirts that you made for fuel for the drag strip for your...
Yeah, you know, because, like, we had to work when I was a kid. You know, my mom and dad, I had four brothers. There was five of us boys. And I think it was, like, when I was 12 years old or something, I started you know, keeping a time card at the shop. I was going to school and keeping a time card at the shop, but I was learning about child labor laws, you know?
Yeah.
So I put my time
sounds
card.
Sounds like my kids, man.
Yeah. I put my time card in an envelope and I wrote a letter to President Nixon. Goes, you know, I'd like to have a day off because I know there's child labor laws, but Big Daddy has us work 70 hours a week. I sent my time card.
And go, man, on, really?
No, dude. Hey, Robert Williams still talks to it to this talks about it to this day, dude. So dig this.
And you're 12 years old.
They sent someone down to the shop to talk to me.
Oh, and my Big God! Daddy, what did Big Daddy say?
Big Daddy went out there with the guy first. You know, he's from the state or whatever, and you know. But so Dad comes in and goes, "They want to talk to you." So I go on the sidewalk. I'm talking to the guy. He goes, "So you know, the child labor laws don't apply to you because these are your parents. They're making you work, and you know." 70 hours a week, you know, going to school and working, you know, it ain't bad. You know, you're learning something, how to build cars and stuff.
They legit came down there.
I told
them. That is so flipping awesome.
But since Dan Woods worked for my dad then, you know, and I knew he was a foster kid, I said, well, you know, if he can't get me a day off, can I go to foster parents? You know, dude. And so then I can imagine, that guy goes, hey, I want to talk to your dad again. You know what I mean? So I went back in the shop and Dad went back out there. But, you know, I'll tell you what. After that, the beating stopped, you know.
Was there a little respect after Big Daddy?
Yeah,
after
he still had to work. But, yeah, he didn't, beat on us. And so when my mom and dad got divorced in 70, I'm the only one that went to live with my dad.
You're the only one?
Yeah.
And how many kids are there total?
Five
total. Boys. Yeah. So five boys, and you guys were always working in the shop with Dad.
Yeah. Okay. And then after that, Dad had women that had kids, and they all say they're Ed's kids. You know, my dad had a vasectomy in 1960. He didn't have it reversed, baby.
He didn't have it reversed.
Yeah. So, but, you know, through that, having to work 70 hours a week, artwork, T-shirts, cars, then I still basically do the same thing. You know what I mean? So many years,
You do just the same thing over here. I mean, the other day, man, I said hi to you again, and I'm like, I didn't have a coffee mug. So you literally took yourself like 5 minutes, and you were talking to me in Austin, and you kind of drew this up here, you know, for me.
Yeah.
And that's what you love doing. And so where did the artistic major come from? From was Dad, or did you learn how to draw? Just all freehand. You learned from
Growing up, Ed Newton, you know, like I said, Robert Williams, Dave Mann, Von Dutch, Von Franco,
epic names, bro.
Larry Watson, all these guys were artists, and I would always tell Dad, "Oh, like I can't airbrush like Franco, or I can't do a painting like Bob can, or you know, I can't do colors like Newt or black and white art like Newt." Like all the T-shirts you ever see of all of our stuff is done by this guy Ed Newton.
So we grabbed a couple of drawings.
55 Chevy.
So like this 55, this epic 55 Chevy. This is Ed Newton drawing.
Yeah,
really. Okay, so now this is, how old is this drawing?
That was 65. See, a lot of people will go around on the T-shirt thing and go, hey, I love your dad's artwork. But my dad's artwork really, just by his own, you know, writings in his first book, he didn't, you know, it wasn't good, you know. So he hired all the right people to do it. He said he was more of a producer. But my dad's artwork came out like this. Building the cars, mixing the plaster, troweling out and making those cars. Yeah. And my dad's pinstriping, his art and lettering. My dad was a great ad agent just setting up stuff.
Yeah.
Like, he was display artist.
He was display artist. And, I mean, all the famous cars that we've seen. Now, obviously, we saw a ton of these over by, like, Shutton's place and all this stuff. I mean, your stuff is all over Shutton's. And Dave's got it. Oh, my God. It's just unreal over there. Let's see what we have going on.
Yeah, and when I was 13, we put all the cars in Movie World Cars of the Stars. And then Dad traded them all to Jimmy Brucker, who owned Cars of the Stars, for a 71 Volkswagen. All the show cars were a 71 Volkswagen. And I think Dad's third non-Mormon wife took off with that car.
You know? Really?
But see, yeah. But after that, Brucker sold them to Bill Hara. And then Bill Hara put the Outlaw and the Beatnik Bandit back to the original colors they were. And my dad and brother were working at Knott's Berry Farm. And so my brother Howard and my dad drove up to Reno every weekend and repainted the Outlaw and Beatnik Bandit the way they were originally.
Oh, so that's sort of, okay.
Right. So then Bill Hara died. And Tom Monahan, who owns Domino's Pizza and the Detroit Tigers, he bought them he bought them all and had them back there in Ann Arbor. Well, Tom went back to work raising money for the nuns that raised him, you know, as a kid, because he was an orphan.
Okay.
And so he sold them to different people. And then, you know, so that's when they went to different people. Like the guy from Nike owns the Road Agent now. And, you know, Peterson Musing got the Outlaw.
Outlaws and Peterson. Yeah.
Bill Harris kept, you know, the Outlaw. So, and then, you know, I guess Galpin's trying to, you know, collect them all because he, you know, they found the Mysterion and the Orbitron.
And then they just find the,
Well, yeah, the Uncertainty.
Uncertainty, yeah. They just saw, we're going to see that in Detroit, I think, yeah.
Yeah. Well, you know, I thought I saw it in Detroit in 2020, but that was a remake some kid made.
Oh, is it really?
Yeah, because I just looked, it was candy red, and it was sitting over there by the Beatnik Band.
Yeah.
I go, well, there's the Uncertainty, but, you know, I didn't read the sign.
Yeah, I didn't read the sign. I don't read the sign. Even some of the stuff when I was over by Shutton's last couple times, I was over there, and I'm like, so I said, are these the original ones, or these makes, or what, I mean, what is all stuff? Because, like, the Mysterion, so that was a tribute car, right?
No, that's the original, unless they just found the seat and the body somewhere. Because, see, when the Mysterion was done, I went over to it one night, opened the bubble, look at it. I pull up the upholstery on the seat. See, we made two seats for the Mysterion.
Okay.
But, see, with the bell housings in there with the two engines, we could only fit one seat in there.
Okay.
So the other seat came to our house, and Dad put, you know, legs on it and stuff, 63.
Really?
And I remember sitting in that all the time, yeah. So I go, it's really hard to recreate, you know, something like that. But, you know, I'm glad they found it. They had it, you know, and redid it. And, you know, Shutton is a great guy. He does great work on restoring stuff, dude.
I think he's amazing.
He's probably number one restorer in the world.
I believe so. I would. As far as restorations go and what he's doing for what he's paying, I don't really know anybody better than Dave Shutton.
No, you know, and yeah, that's a good thing that, you know, both but got him over there at that gas building to do all that stuff. Because, like,
him and Bo are just amazing together. They just click so great, right?
Yeah, it's a good thing. And so, like, what Dad told me, I told him, look, Dad, you traded all our cars, man, for a Volkswagen, a Brucker. And he goes, you know what? Anyone can own those cars, but they'll always be ours. And you know what? That's through cool. the years, you that's find cool. out that he's right. And no one ever calls that car. Our cars, they go, it's a Roth car. They don't call it a Ford or a Chevy or nothing else.
No, it's a Roth car.
Yeah,
man.
That's why we wanted to get rid of that. You know, my mom and dad got rid of the Tweety Pie right away, but that was just to go in the lineup for Revell.
That was just going in the lineup for Revell.
Yeah, that was so. That belonged to my dad's friend by the name of Bob Johnston.
Okay.
And so Dad bought it for him. Actually, he bought Bob Johnston a pool for his house in Anaheim.
Really?
Yeah. Wow. Yeah, because Dad was bucks up from Revell then.
Okay, so over the years, so was it always the contract just for Revell, or was it Monogram too?
No, Revell, because Revell was separate of Monogram. And then when they made the first Hot Wheel Beatnik Bandit, they had a license through Revell.
Okay, yeah, because obviously nowadays we have, how many cars were licensed through Revell? Offhand?
Oh, 10.
10?
Okay. Yeah. And because we had the Monster models in with those too. They couldn't make the cars fast enough. You just couldn't do it.
We couldn't do it. Yeah, you couldn't make cars fast enough.
It took us a year to make the body for the Road Agent, dude.
Oh, yeah. I mean, well, that's what I'm saying. You're talking in the 60s and early 70s when you guys are making these cars. Yeah. They don't have any of the technology that we have now. I mean, these guys are just 3D printing stuff and whatever they're doing now.
Right.
This is all just paperwork and scratching.
And the first cars, like the Outlaw and Beatnik Bandit, the buck was made out of solid plaster. And, you know, it wasn't until around the Orbitron where we started putting the different medias like vermiculite or foam in there to get it so we could do it with the SureForm. So, you know, the first cars were ground to shape.
That is crazy, man.
Yeah, I know.
And all the dust and everything that you inhaled as a kid, and you're still alive, you're kicking it. Yeah. People are like, oh, you got a mask on. And you're 8 years old saying it.
You know what? Fiberglass cars, after the buck was done, you'd be fiberglass over the outside and then grind it smooth and, you know, do that. They only made one, you know, we didn't make a mold of them, except for the trikes, you know, after.
Yeah, I was going to say, I was going to touch base on the trikes because you made a ton of trikes.
Yeah, so that was after, like, you know, the cars were gone. We started in on the Volkswagen trikes. We first cut up the wishbone, this Volkswagen car we made, but it had a narrowed Volkswagen rear end in it.
Okay.
But Dad wanted people to be able to buy a Volkswagen kit where they didn't have to have the rear end narrowed.
Okay.
So we
take the back head chassis off with the motor and put it in there.
Yeah. So Dad just welded the wishbone back together and sold it to Dirty Doug for $100. And we went down and got like a Volkswagen across the street and started building those trikes. And then, but Dad knew
built a lot of trikes.
Yeah. He thought it was going to be like, you know, even a better deal than it was. I mean, I loved riding them on them and everything. But so we got a patent on them, a United States patent on them.
You do have a patent on them?
Yeah. From 1970 to 77, every Volkswagen trike sold was, you know, but my mom and dad didn't want to make like full kit, full cars, because if you put a trike together and then sell it, someone gets hurt, it's screwed. But you had to buy the kit from us. So we sold the bodies and the chassis. And you just got a old...
The marketing that you guys had or your father had was just blows me away that... I mean, what was his background before? I mean, was he always just in the cars? I mean, because obviously... I mean, like my dad, I always say he was like, you know, he didn't go to school past eighth grade because that's just what happened back then.
Yeah.
But I mean, like, this is unbelievable. Like, the marketing he had, I mean, we're talking
well,
about...
Well, you know, Dad, he never missed a day of school when he was going to school. From kindergarten to, like, you know, when he was a senior in high school, never missed a day.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Perfect attendance at school.
That's crazy,
so
man.
He just said he just wanted to get out of the house and away from Opa, you know? And
So
he joined the Air Force the, you know, minute he got out of high school, just
so
like
I did. He just booted because you did the same thing. We were talking about you.
Yeah.
So 17, and when you were 17, you got sent out to Vietnam War. You were in Germany, right?
Yeah.
And then what was your label there? You told me this before.
Oh, I was a topographical surveyor.
In 17, you got to school. I mean, topographical survey.
Going into the Army after the first 16 years with Big Daddy was like a cakewalk, dude. People go, oh, you're going in the Army, they're gonna kill you in like basic training.
Yeah,
like I went there and I was like, what?
This is it's like easy, right?
You can't even beat on me with a 2x4. That, you know, that
they're gonna do anything, man. You know how I grew up, brother?
Exactly. So, you know, in that way, it was a lot better deal. But the trikes, you know, it encompassed like the seat. The driver's seat was lower than both axles, and both seats were in front of the front axle. It has to have some good for the country and stuff. So what ended up happening is right after 1970, when the contract or the Department of Commerce gave the patent on it, is that they started building these Marx big wheels where the seat was lower than both axles. And you
really?
Can spin them out for kids and stuff.
Come on, really?
So you know how there's lawyers that are always looking like, hey, is someone going to infringe on your rights here or do something here and there, you know, and they go, hey, you know what, this guy's over here is going to build a thing called a big wheel and it's infringing on your rights.
You
know,
really?
yeah
oh my god, that's
the only money he really made off him was like from a toy company. But you know, it's just like the ones that like the one in Elvis's museum over there in Graceland, his trike, you know, was put together by someone else, but you know, with all our parts.
But it was all your parts, because
we didn't sell full bikes because my mom and dad didn't want no one crash on them and then come back on them. So we sold
so it's a liability cost, because if you sold a full running vehicle, that's totally different. Now you get like a dealership, you know.
Yeah, we sold the chassis, the body, the handlebar, everything you needed to make it,
you know,
but you had to put it together.
That makes so much sense, because what you guys were doing in the 60s and 70s, there were so many kits.
Yeah.
Everybody had kits. I mean, you got
the T-Bucket kits.
T-Bucket, everything. You get from like J.C. Whitney's or Sears. So, I mean, you buy a T-Bucket from them. But you couldn't, they would sell it running. But as a kit that you could put together, and it was on your hind end.
Yeah.
If it crashed or fell apart, going on school.
Sure.
Very smart marketing.
Yeah. And, you know, a guy that owned the Deuce factory back in the day, Roy Fiesta, he told me, he goes, I sell cars. But he goes, when I sell a car, he goes, I tell the guy to bring your own wheels and tires. I want to keep my wheels and tires. So if anything goes on liable like that too, he goes,
wow.
Well, like, hey, I sold you a car, but you put your wheels and tires on it before you drove it away.
Oh, really? And that's just that little
thing takes away the liability. Yeah, but I didn't know that, you know, back in the day. But, you know.
Well, you got to read all the loopholes. It only takes one incident or do whatever, and I get it.
Yeah, because I think after, you know, the Rotar blew up at Cobo Hall and hurt some people and the fan, you know, the car that flew.
Yeah.
And I think my mom and dad were really watching out for that then.
Oh, yeah, for sure, yeah.
Could happen.
What year was that the Rotar blew up? That was early
64.
64.
Yeah, yeah. There's a picture of a cop holding up, you know, as part of the fan blades in Cobo Hall. And
really?
It says, you know, people injured at Cobo Hall and everything. I go, hey, Dad, what were you thinking about, you know, when the cop was holding them parts? He goes, well, I was hoping they weren't going to look at the engines in there and see that the numbers were ground off. You know, like all those early cars, like the Rotar, you know, Mysterion.
Yeah.
They had some questionable things as to where, you know,
where the parts came from.
Dick Cook and, you know, Fritz Boyd and Tommy Greer from Greer Black and Prudhomme, they'd go out and get cars at night.
They'd go get a car tonight, so you guys get to build them.
You know, like my dad's 55 Chevy, when you opened the hood, it said Thunderbird on the valve covers.
Really?
You know, oh, yeah, it had a 390 in it.
A 390 in it, yeah. Dude, that's so funny, man.
And then
they're just going through.
Tom Wolfe came out there to write that book, you know, the candy-colored tangerine flake streamlined baby. And he goes,
yeah,
I got in Red Ross race car, and we drove over to this other place. And I go, well, it wasn't really his race car. It was a tow car. But without a trailer on the back, the thing hauled ass. You know, it had a 390 and a C6 in it. It was a whipping up. But and the 283 out of that 55 Chevy actually went into the Orbitron.
Oh, really? Okay, yeah. Gotcha. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, that's killer, man. That is really cool. Yeah. Oh, man, that is so cool. So 2024, you're still out doing shows. You're out doing autographs.
Yeah.
What's next for you? What are you doing?
Well, you know
how much guys you got into.
Yeah, when Dad died, I started the metal flake bat. You know, the whole deal. And since then, I've got, you know, I still have metal flake, but I have candy colors, base coats, clear. I got like a whole gambit of paint now, you know, automotive finishes. So that's what I've been running. Like in these models right now, they put my ads for the deal. And Atlantis is calling me and they called me. They want to do those little paints like Dad had, the testers paints for the models.
Yeah.
So we're going to start doing that with Atlantis.
Okay. That is really cool. Because you still sell the flake. I mean, I see you on different shows. I see you on, you know, I mean, obviously you've been on a couple shows with like Ian Show and stuff that. Yeah. I mean, you guys do a lot of stuff together. Yeah. You put your flake on everything, man.
Yeah.
And it's so cool.
Well, we live out in the desert and the flake shows up good in the sun. You know?
Oh, my God. It shows up great.
Yeah, because before we made the Volkswagen trikes, we made the Cobra trikes like Dick Allen had.
Yeah.
And one of the Maywood cops kid got killed on one. And that's when my mom kind of.
Come on, really?
Yeah.
What year was that?
67. He was racing a 67 or a 68 GTX over in Bell, California on the Captain America V8 trike. Ernie
Captain
Flanagan.
America, man. Holy cow, man. That was really cool.
I hit a dip and like the whole bike just, you know, destroy itself. So my mom was really kind of down on those V8 trikes. People got hurt on them, man. They're
kind of uncontrollable. I mean, a lot of things were made for look. It's kind of like the Zingers and all the other cool stuff you guys made, but they weren't practical, you know?
Right.
Yeah. That's dangerous stuff.
Dad drove his around a lot, but like we never really raced. We used to drive the California Cruiser back and forth from Maywood to Buena Park every weekend, you know, dad wasn't really, he was more about looks than, you know,
dad was a showman, man.
Yeah. He goes, once you get on the throttle, dude, then he goes, you're replacing engine parts.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
But, it is, because it's just like anything. It's just like any kind of racing, you know? And now you guys were the drag racing circuit. So now was more for the show, or you did have a couple drag cars, didn't you?
Yeah. It was more for that. 64 dad had a Ram Charger. He was racing a Hemi.
Yep.
And then, George, the Bushmaster, had Jim Davis build him a chassis, but he didn't have the money for the body.
Okay.
And Dad goes, well, I'll tell you what, we'll make a dragster, but I'm going to, him and Dad and Steve Swazia designed it and made a clay mold of it and took it down to Tom Hanna, Tom Hanna built that body for the Yellow Fang. And, you know,
really?
But today,
no kidding,
like, I think it was November when I was down at Don Garlitz's, Don goes, some guy offered him $1.3 million.
Come on, really?
$1.3 million for the Yellow Fang. He didn't take it. I go, man, you crazy, man.
And what year is this?
It's 1965. The first year they lifted the nitro ban, we had a top fuel dragster called the Yellow Fang.
So did he get offered that kind of money in that year?
Oh, no, not that year. No, this was just in November.
Oh, man, that's crazy.
The Yellow Fang Dragster is now down at Don Garlitz's museum.
I was saying, yeah, we're actually going to go down there next month, I think, to see Don,
And then Don was telling me, I got offered a man three, some Arab guys wanted to have that car, and he goes, he didn't sell it. And I go, wow, you know what? Dad probably flipping in his grave.
Dad's flipping his grave. Yeah, you should have sold my car, dude, for a million.
I think Tom Hanna told me he charged Dad $2,500 to build that body for it.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, I know.
What an investment. 60s down to $1.3 million for a car.
Yeah.
But, I mean, look at the industry now. I mean, and just the merch alone, you know, obviously I got my own collection of stuff at home, but I went and grabbed a couple of these, you know, the repops here, you know, to kind of talk about the models and everything we have going on. And they're literally at every stand all over the place. I mean, it's just so epic to see it everywhere.
Yeah, and you know, actually one of my best T-shirts right now that I'm selling, the artwork was done by Bob, you know, but since he was Bob when he worked for my dad, now he's Robert Williams, you know, Appetite for Destruction and everything, documentaries.
So the whole Robbie Williams thing, right?
Well, Robert Williams, Robbie Williams, I think he was a singer from
The one that's England. The one that's in Shutton's place. Robbie Williams display there.
Yeah.
Okay.
Robbie Williams is a singer, but Bob changed his name to Robert, RBT, WMS. Yeah.
Okay.
You know, I told him once, I go, Bob, you know how the way I was raised? And he goes, oh, yeah, you were raised just like your dad was, you know, like German militaristic style. And I go,
and I think everything that you guys do and going through, I mean, how many shows do you still do a year, you think? Going out to see people?
Not the same people, but the same shows, like, you know, Oakland Roadster Show, Daryl Starbird, you know, forever.
You guys been here since day one, right?
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah.
My dad and Daryl Starbird were, you know, friends long ago, like when Dad had the Outlaw and Daryl had this Predicta.
Yeah, Daryl had Predicta.
Yeah, and then Canning Shows, and then Bob Larrabee, you know, World of Wheels, that, you know, my dad even sold the Outlaw and the Beatnik Bandit to Bob Larrabee at one time.
Right, and now Pete's running it all. You know,
Now Pete runs the deal.
Now Pete runs the deal, but it's just amazing the history that we have going through all these cars. And I see this. I see they got the Starbird over signing autographs this weekend, doing stuff, and with the poster from the Mysterion too. You know.
Yeah, dude. You know what? Car shows, like I went to car shows before they were in big arenas like this. I remember going to, like, J.C. Penney's parking lot in Huntington Park with the Outlaw, and you know. On Pacific Avenue there in Huntington Park is where Dirty Doug went over and bought the Hirohata Merc from Hirohata's widow. She lived behind Pep Boys on Pacific.
Come on, really?
Yeah, dude. So like
the same one that's in Shutton's right now.
Yeah, the real Hirohata Merc.
The real Hirohata.
Dirty Doug owned that when we were building the Beatnik Bandit.
And that was still in the 60s too, right?
Right. And then the guy goes, oh, I found the Hirohata Merc on a lot in Long Beach. Well, the lot in Long Beach, Dad, in 1959, Dad, Dirty Doug, Larry Watson, George Barris, who was their other?
Winfield, probably all the guys.
Yeah, they all went out and bought brand new 59 Cadillacs.
Really?
And Dirty Doug traded in the Hirohata Merc for a brand new 59 Cadillac.
Come on,
yeah,
really?
Dude, wow. Is that a trip?
That's a major trip. That just blows my mind.
So there was a lot of early things going on, you know, at the shop, you know, that probably I didn't really know about until I was like, you know, got a little older.
And you got a little older.
When I had to work, you know, when I had to start working 70 hours a week instead of just a few.
when you're in 4K, you didn't really know what's going on. But by the time you're second, you're educated and doing the books. Yeah. I know how that life goes.
Hey, you know, when I was a little kid, I thought the Beatnik Bandit was this giant car, right?
Because
I was so little. But like now,
it's just,
you know,
the little thing, dude.
Yeah, Dad could never even fit in it himself with the bubble down.
No way. I mean, How big was Dad? I mean, it was
6'2"? 6'3". 6'2", 6'3".
He was 6'2", 6'3". He's a big dude.
Yeah. And sometimes, you know, he weighed like almost 300 pounds, like on that picture of Dad leaning against the Nash Metropolitan.
Yeah, yeah.
All his Hell's Angel gear on.
Yeah, with all Hell's Angel gear.
Yeah.
So, like, I picked a picture like that with all the Hell's Angel. Was that just a spoof to get back at people and doing stuff?
No, because like for a while he was, you know, hanging out. The guy who started the Hell's Angels, his name was Otto Friedley, and he used to hang out with these guys, Dougie Poo and Buzzard. And Buzzard is still alive today.
But I was just gonna say Buzzard's still alive.
Yeah, yeah. They go by as the early timers now. And I know Ralph White. He won like Springfield, Daytona. He won Laconia. And I go out to breakfast with them almost every morning. You know what I mean?
Get out of here, really?
Arizona. Yeah,
that is so cool.
Factory Harley rider from the 60s and won Springfield and Laconia and Daytona on a really? USA. Yeah.
And the original starters and guys from the Hells Angels. And
yeah. The guys who started it. Yeah.
And you old dudes are just chilling and having breakfast every morning.
Yeah. It's like, oh, man, you know, like, and talking about the old days, it's kooky, you know, like even today, you know, it's hard to believe that the life you lived, you know, like working at Lions every weekend at the drag strip and seeing the evolution of funny cars, seeing the, you know, evolution of drag racing, you know, I guess, you know, in a lot of ways, I'm just a lucky guy.
You are. I mean, we're here. I mean, we didn't get to touch base on it because I just love your history too. I mean, we're here. I mean, I'm here at this show this year representing Evel Knievel and over 50 years of excellence and Snake River Canyon and all that stuff. But I mean, you yourself are, I mean, ever since I met you, I was so honored because, I mean, you're a legend in my mind. I mean, as a kid growing up.
It wouldn't be there if it wasn't, you know, for all that work. And that's one thing I probably learned from my dad the most is just like persevere and keep working because if you do it on your own, you know, like whenever I go anywhere and they have me talk about the cars now, like the Motorcyclopedia Museum, it's like, man, you can remember so much, like, you know, from each car, like, oh, the problem we had with that and this and that, you know, but.
And you could tell stories on every single one of them. I mean, guys like you, like there's going to be, and you and I are going to talk about it later, about some stuff that we got going on, your stuff, maybe doing a little history, a little documentary on your life and the history of I think it'd be awesome, dude.
Like I was telling you, dude, like when we had Choppers Magazine and Dad was interviewing Evel Knievel and like I'm 10, 12, 13 years old in the years we had that. And we'd be talking to Evel Knievel out in Los Angeles at the LA Sports Arena.
Yeah.
And I'd be taking pictures and Dad's talking to Evel and then Evel would undo the top of his cane, you know, and take off the top and take a big drink out of his cane, you know. It's like, man, you know, I never seen that before. I go, hey, Dad, you know, what's Evel doing? You know, and
he goes, what's Evel doing, Dad?
Yeah, he's got booze all up in his cane, you know, and I go, wow. But, you know, he was already limp then. He was flying the Sportster with the little short wings on it.
That was in the parking lot. No, that was early 70s then, right? That was...
It had to have been 67, 68, or 69 because... That's when we had Choppers Magazine.
Yeah, you had Choppers Magazine. Yeah. And a lot of people, and again, we didn't even touch it back on that because Choppers Magazine that people still follow this day, you guys started Choppers Magazine.
Yeah. Yeah. I worked for Choppers Magazine when I was like a little kid. My dad made my older brother quit high school to work the dark room. Howard, yeah, my brother.
Dad, you know, I want to be a doctor. Get a dark room. Get a dark room. Shut up. I don't care. We got magazines to print now. Yeah. You know, it's like you guys are like leaders in the industry and icons of what's going on. Everybody sees some people I even see that who don't know your history.
Yeah.
And of course, you know me, I'm a knucklehead. I love all the history of everything. Cause we just talk about any kind of crap. You and I can get lost in a corner for 2 hours talking about a paint job in a car.
Yeah.
And I love doing that with you. It's great. But I mean, everybody thinks you're just a cartoonist or something like that.
Yeah.
I'm like, no, I'm like, check out, you know, the cars that you're owners of. And they don't realize the car. I'm like, that's your history.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh yeah, well that was his dad. I'm like, no, dude, that's him.
Yeah. Well, you know what? Here's the thing that Big Daddy always told us when we were kids. He goes, you know, our job is to sell T-shirts. But he goes, these cars are the signs to bring the people over to the booth for the T-shirts.
Yeah.
And then we knew that right off the bat. You know, like even when I was 10 years old, I knew that they had the road agent or the Orbitron out there, you know, a remote control working them in front of the booth because it was the sign.
Yeah.
To bring people over to buy a shirt. Yeah.
Any idea, do you think, from when Dad first started and what the earliest, 63, 64? When do you think he first sold his first T-shirt?
Oh, for sure back in 50s because 58, 57, 58, 59, because they were airbrushing shirts at the car shows had to have something to do. You know, my dad said, stop at JCPenney and get some dollar T-shirts and airbrush a shirt. Well, once he started making characters like Rat Fink or Mother's Worry or like Wild Child, then it got too much. So that's when we actually started silk screening shirts.
So Rat Fink.
Yeah.
So Rat Fink as we have here today.
Yeah.
And of course, Rat Fink and Trixie are here. You know, these two of the most epic people on the planet here.
Yeah.
What year did Rat Fink come out?
Well, the first copyright was 63. And then I think, copyrights are forever. And then I think the people up in Utah, the Utah Corporation, like trademarked it in 2001, probably the year Dad died.
Okay, gotcha.
So it's a trademark. But a trademark you got to keep up, a copyright's forever.
Everything. Oh my gosh, we know.
You know that.
What do you think, and if just an estimate in your mind or your calculations, How many t-shirts do you think you guys have ever sold from day one till right now in 2024?
You know, I would say with t-shirts and stickers and wrapping keychains, easily over a million.
It's got to be, bro.
Wrapping keychains, those were actually came out. Some guy made those and put them in gum machines, you know?
Yeah.
And then dad called them up like in 1962 and said, hey, you know what? I own Rat Pink. And the guy goes, well, I don't know. I have no money. I just made the Rat Pink keychains and put them. Then the guy, dad goes, well, give me a million keychains. And the guy did, you know, because he was really? Taiwan or something. Yeah. So for a long time, we had keychains we actually threw away when my mom and dad got divorced, bags of them.
Because dad had so many of them.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, I think the best part about everything that we touch base on with all you guys from the 50s and 60s. And I mean, that's how I got into it. Cause I watched my dad negotiate. It was just epic to me as a kid, just going with him and doing whatever. And even what Evil did is promoting and how he did his stuff. It was amazing. Cause there was no like kids, you know, I mean, I got some young guys working for me. What are you going for? Oh, I'm going for business. I'm going for this sort of business. Like you guys didn't have that. We grew up on the streets, man.
Yeah.
And you guys promoted yourself just like that. You make a phone call. It's like, those are my keychains. What do you want to do? Give me a million and we'll call it even.
Yeah.
You know,
but you know, it's like in 1962, dad took the Beatnik Bandit to the Oakland Roadster Show and it didn't win America's Most Beautiful Roadster. However, that year in 62 at the SEMA show, it won World's Best Engineered Car. And so since 1962, dad told the promoter, I'm not going for no trophies no more. From now on, you pay me. And that set a precedent too in the show car world.
Because and what year was that?
62. Because
1962, your dad made a presence to get paid to go to a show.
Yes, because the people wanted to see the Beatnik Bandit and the Outlaw and the road agent because they were all big models. And, you know, we had like just garages full of trophies, 6-foot trophies from Mickey Thompson's and Pomona, all this, that. And dad goes, you know what? Now I want a free booth. I want to be paid to come because the guys didn't pick the Beatnik Bandit for the world's most beautiful roadster because dad and Frank Petragon were using Nylock nuts then.
Okay.
And at the end of your tie rods, you're supposed to have them drilled and pinned.
Yeah, drilled and pinned. Yeah.
Yeah. So, but the judges had never seen Nylocks in 62. And so when they saw the Nylocks on, they go, oh, points off the Beatnik Bandit for not having, you know, drilled and pinned.
Really?
And dad goes, that's it. That's it.
So something like that.
Yeah.
Really?
I'm done with it. And then he would use that as promotions too, like if people were there and trying to sell German helmets like we were, or he would tell them, the promoter, Blackie or Baggy, whoever it was, he'd tell them, get that guy out of here or I won't bring the road agent next year. And guess what? That guy was out. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. You know, so Big Daddy had a little bit of power once, you know, with the toy company.
With the
models and stuff. So, and that's when he started just saying, like, I ain't coming, dude, for a trophy no more. You guys don't even know what a Nylock is.
Because he didn't even know what it was. Yeah. And even now with the model kits are still being reproduced today in 2024.
Yeah, and as a matter of fact, I'm getting together with Atlantis. They called me. They want to make a new, like, line of testers paint, the Ed Big Daddy Rock colors.
Yeah, I was going to say.
You're going to make the Little Daddy car colors now.
You're making Little Daddy car colors?
Yeah.
It is so amazing to me that you are still out here promoting and networking and everything that you do. All the time. It never stops. And I don't think a lot of people realize that. What it is, it's a 24/7 job. I mean, you started this, you could have just hung this up and said, I'll just do whatever and all that stuff.
Yeah.
Not only are you here, you could have had a couple hotties down in the booth down there and you could be sipping and, you know, whatever you want to go. You love this. I mean, look at your face,
man.
Yeah,
you know what? You know what it is? It's not like just a hobby. A lot of people like say it's a hobby. For me, it is my life.
You
know,
dude, you live it. That's exactly. We do. We live this stuff. Right.
It's a lifestyle and not. Like,
oh my god,
like
I love it.
Yeah,
that's what we did when I started the Motor Mania brand. We're like, it's not just a brand, it's a lifestyle, man.
That's
it is. And it's a lifestyle. It's all we know. It's still all I know is growing up.
Yeah,
everybody's like, what did you do last night? Like, I don't know. I said, I was talking to a little daddy for a while and stuff, and saw Scratch and Murph and all those guys are chopping top down. And it was like, oh my god, it's so epic. And I'm like, we're just coming to hang out. They're all normal dudes, man.
Yeah, right.
Even Rawlings, I mean, we're hanging out, and some guy made a comment on some social, and he's like, you know, blah blah blah. And you know, he's such a jerk. I'm like, dude, he's a cool guy. He's a promoter.
Yeah, yeah.
How can you get mad at somebody it goes back to the famous saying, don't get mad at what you don't have for the work you didn't put in.
Right. You know, and that came back to me because, like, when I was 20 years old, that's when I first met Jeff Beck, you know, and I was thinking, man, you know, he's a big-time hitter, guitar player and shit. And then, you know, after you go to his house a couple of times and you see all this hot rods and you go, man, you know what? This guy is just another hot rodder.
Yes.
And you know, cause I asked him when I was, you know, like back in, when I was 20, 49 years ago, I asked him, hey Jeff, you know, what about this guy, you know, whoever it was, Ingwe Malmsteen? He goes, you know what, Dennis? He goes, I was lucky. When I was a kid, the Yardbirds hired me.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And he goes, and then my other.
Jeff Beckman.
Yeah, and then my other friend who has a band called Sublime, Bud from Long Beach, he goes,
yeah.
Dude, you know, he goes, it is luck. But he goes, you make your luck as well.
Yeah.
So, you know, two of these big guys that, you know, then they're all car guys. Like Jimmy, ZZ Top.
Oh, yeah, Billy Gibbons.
Billy, man, a big car guy. You know, you wouldn't even know.
Billy
you see him all the car shows. You see him everywhere, you know.
Billy is salt of the earth, just like you guys are.
Yeah, that's what I mean. So, like, any guy, it doesn't. So, like, even if you have some money when you get a little older, you're a rock star or whoever, you're going to spend your money on cars. Well, anyway, it just shows to Goya that, you know, many guys, a lot of people are into the different hot rod genres and, you know, the more money you got, the more cards you got, right?
Yeah, exactly. You know, it's like, you know, as far as you're doing stuff and as far as it goes, it's like, you know, as far as everything I got going on, I think it's unbelievable. I mean, even the crowds here today, the people that are going on, all the genres and doing stuff, I think it's great. You know, I think, yeah. And people know your name no matter where you go. And it's just, I think it's great. I think it's epic what you do, man. And I love what you're doing. And, you know, I'm going to have you sign a couple things and maybe autograph the new cool trailer that we're doing.
Mr. Gasser.
And what's your favorite one? You got to have a favorite, right, before we head out?
I think my favorite car of all was the Druid Princess.
Really?
Because we could drive it a lot around. And you know what? Dodge actually gave us that engine. That engine in that car still to this day probably has less than 1,000 miles on it.
Are you serious?
Yeah.
Are you serious? Oh, my God. Oh, my God.
Thank you, Chrysler, for that engine.
That is so epic. So, over the years, obviously, I'm sitting here at Starbirds, and we got a couple things we've been doing here. We're bringing Evil back for a 50-year reunion of all this other stuff.
Right.
What best memory do you got of Evil, and what over the years of doing stuff? Because you had to see
well,
it many
I guess
times over here.
My
you know?
Uncle Bob taking, you know, his he had a Volkswagen trike, you know, that we made back in the day, and he went up to watch Evil jump the canyon up there.
Yeah.
And he was up there on his trike then, so there was a Roth trike represented at the Evil jump. And I remember all that leading up to it. And you know, I remember being in Vegas. I wasn't there when he jumped the deals, but I remember being there in that era, you know, 63 or whenever it was, 64.
Yeah.
Yeah, Evel Knievel was a big hitter. And then, like I said, when he came to the Canning show in L.A. at the sports arena, you know, I was just in awe of him. And,
you know,
even after I did see him taking drinks out of his cane,
I think that's the best part of the whole story. Yeah. I think that's the best part of the whole story.
Wild.
Well, man, well, it looks like the crowds are getting going here, man. It's almost noon already here. And then,
is it? Wow.
Yeah, I suppose we better get down your booth. You've been hanging out with me for like an hour and a half, I think. You know?
I better get out of here.
You better get out of here. My
mind's going to be shot. But
yeah, you're going to be like, I got nothing to tell you today because I gave it all the bag upstairs, man. So, all right, everybody. Well, let's walk. Thanks for having Little Daddy on the show today. And we're going to sign some stuff. Do whatever, brother.
All right, bro.
All right.
To you guys later.
All right. Later, brother. Thanks for being on the show.